Hello and welcome to The Unstoppable Woman, Season 2. My next guest, Kiran Manral, is an author, speaker, columnist, mentor, and a feminist. Her power to captivate readers with her books of fiction, as well as her compelling insights, make her truly unstoppable. Her latest book, Rising, 30 Women Who Changed India, gives us a peek into the lesser-known facets of 30 successful Indian women. We are really thrilled to have Kiran on the show to speak about the book and more. Welcome to the show, Kiran.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
You know, I'd really love for you to speak more about the latest book. But before we do that, like a lot of our listeners, I'm really keen to know more about how you got into writing in the first place and how you have covered so many varied topics. You know, it's not only one genre. From supernatural to horror, humor, parenting, motherhood, and the list goes on, you know, and it is so engrossing. But the one book is complete and then another book opens up, but the topic is completely different. How do you do this?
I sort of put it down to a low boredom threshold, Shelja, to be honest. So I really admire those who can write within the same genre and the same space over and over again. It gives them a kind of depth and expertise that I can't even dare to claim. But put it down to my low boredom threshold. If I write something that's really very serious, then I need to offset it by a very light-hearted, funny book the next time around, and so on and so forth. But I think the genesis for this varied kind of portfolio that I have comes from my journalistic days when I dabbled in everything from business writing to crime, to reporting, to women's issues, features, entertainment. So I did it all at that point, and I think I continue trying to do it all now. Whether successfully or not, I don't know, but that's what it is.
So tell us a bit more about Rising and why you thought it needs to be written.
These stories have been told before, let me be very honest. We know about these women. They're famous women. They're women who have been there, done things. We've read about them in the newspapers. We've watched their movies. We've listened to their songs. We've seen their accomplishments on television. My editor at Rupa, Shaswati Bora, she came to me with this idea that we want to do a compilation of women who have been inspiring in a way that tells their stories with empathy and kindness. And that's basically what it was. It was a compilation of women from different walks of life, from different spheres, from politics to art to literature to entertainment, everything. Women who have just been there and done their thing and, you know, gone against sometimes great odds to do those things. And that's what this book is about. It's about just telling their stories.
But was it a very large pool of lists to choose from? 1.4 billion population. I'm sure there are lot many women out there and interesting stories.
There are, I'm sure. And there are a lot of women I wish I could have included. And I'm sure my publishers would have wanted to include, because this list went back and forth many times. And there are some women who were there initially on the list, and it changed. It changed over the past 4 years that it has been in the making. So there's so many women I would have loved to write about who aren't there in the book. And I'm sure it would not be possible to humanly write about every woman I thought should have been there. But the ones who are there, I'm grateful that they lived their lives the way they did so I could write about them. Yeah.
But specifically, I think when you're writing about women or women agendas, right? So there is something which is where you're drawing your inspiration from. Is it just your personal journey as a woman? What inspires you to pick up such topics?
I don't think when I write it's about other women, it's a personal thing. It is just, I think, how the women have impacted other women around them. For instance, if you take somebody like, from the book, you take a Fatima Bibi. She was the first woman judge of the Supreme Court. She was a Muslim girl from a small village in Kerala. And she rose to be this achiever, a quiet achiever, somebody who is so reclusive that even now it's very difficult to, you know, get in touch with her or reach out to her. These are women who not many young girls would know about. There's Harita Kaur Deol, who was the first Indian woman pilot in the Indian Air Force. So not many people know about her. There's also Madhuri Dixit, whom everybody knows about. So I wanted to bring these women together in a way. These are women we all know, but these are women you should know and you need to know about, and you need to talk about these women as well. So I think this was the kind of juxtaposition that I was trying to create, you know, names that are universally known and loved: Lata Mangeshkar, Madhuri Dixit, Ma Shweta Devi. Also your little unknown names, your Harita Kaur Deol, your Fatima Bibi. These names we need to celebrate. Tessie Thomas. These names we need to celebrate as much, if not more.
Right. So I think there was one fiction which I was listening to one of your interviews, in which you've written this Kitty Party Murder, if I remember it correctly, and that also had multiple different characters and shades of women, right? But more in the fiction space and with a comic angle to it, and it was very interesting as a conversation. So do you want to share a little bit about that?
Okay. So that's The Kitty Party Murder and The Reluctant Detective. The Reluctant Detective was my very first book. It was published in 2011. It is basically set in the gated community, suburban community of Mumbai, where women who are professionally well qualified have dropped out of the workforce for whatever reasons, childcare or whatever. And this lost. They're searching for something to do, you know, to occupy themselves. They are unsure about getting back into the formal workforce because so much time has passed, perhaps. And, you know, confidence has ebbed, and or maybe they've gotten too comfortable with not working. I don't know. There are many reasons. And Kay Mehra, that's the protagonist in this, is a typical school-gate mom with a six-year-old and with everything that goes with it, you know, birthday parties, weight issues, little groups of people. And what happens? Kay Mehra gets involved in stuff she shouldn't do, investigating murders. So that's what that's what The Reluctant Detective was. And then The Kitty Party Murder is the next in, I wouldn't call it a series, they're just two books out. This is the next in the Kay Mehra set of books about how she sort of has to get into a kitty party group to find out whether somebody has really died by suicide, or has been compelled to commit suicide, or to die by suicide, or has been killed. So that's what it is. And it's not hardcore crime or investigation. It's not a procedural. So anyone get looking for a, you know, crime thriller procedural, please. No, this is just pure humor. This is P.G. Woodhouse. This is Terry Pratchett. This is that kind of writing.
So P.G. Woodhouse has had a very great influence on you, right? You've spoken a lot about the style of writing and different books. Any other author comes to your mind?
So I read my two extremes, Stephen King and P.G. Woodhouse. So I go from horror to humor. I guess, like, to say my reading habits are very bipolar.
Very interesting, though, because see, I think what you feel in one is feeding energy for the other, right? So it balances. So I get you. Where are you coming from? Total opposites feeding into each other.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it makes for some interesting writing, and in the sense that a poor reader will pick up Kitty Party Murder and laugh, or pick up Once Upon a Crush and laugh their lungs out, and then they will pick up more things in Heaven and Earth or Face of the Window and say, oh my God, let me put the lights on and open the windows. Where are these ghosts coming from?
That's the one in which the protagonist is connecting with her husband. That's
More
that's,
Things in Heaven and Earth. Yeah, that's the one.
Interesting. My one question, you know, whenever I look at very inspiring personalities like yourself, is like, how do you keep that mojo alive? When you said that after giving birth to a child, you know, most of the women, they sort of get into that role of or complacency or comfortable and let go of me time or, you know, priorities for the self. But what sets unstoppable women apart is because you keep feeding into your dreams and say, okay, I want this. I drive all my energies from this and I'll keep the flame alive. So what is yours? I mean, how did you keep your mojo alive all these years, Kiran? What keeps you going?
I don't know if I kept my mojo alive, very honest. To be very honest, it was, you know, being a precocious child who wrote awful poetry and short stories as a child. And my mom has a big stack of them, which she'll probably blackmail me with someday. And in some forgotten moment, I must have told her, Mom, I'm going to be a writer, not from an ignorant. So she held on to that, like, you know how moms. And every year she would ask me, so when are you writing your book? And I'm like, no, I'm working at the Times of India now. I'm very important. I'm very busy. No, I'm doing this. I've started my own company. I'm very busy. No, I've had a kid. I have no time. So that kept happening every single year until one fine day, I was 39 and I was going to hit 40. And she said, so are you finally ever going to write your book? And I took a good look, hard look at myself and said, oh shit, it's 40. I better do something about it. So that's how the first book came about. And I just kept going. I just kept writing. I don't know if I was trying to find my mojo. If I found my mojo, I didn't find my mojo or whatever. But there's a saying in Hindi, Sherne Khoon Chak Liya. So I think that's what happened. I sort of enjoyed the process. It's a horrible process that no one kid you that writing books is easy and you just have to sit at the desk and it pours out of you. Nothing like that. It's a very tormented kind of a profession because A, you don't get paid also, and then you have to take time off from your bread and butter work to do it. But I think I like telling stories, so I just continued, and it was very flattering that people were taking time to read these stories. So that's just what it was.
Is it also a medium of catharsis for you? Because I write myself, but I write prose and poems since childhood. But it was more of out of expression, being a shy child, you know, so words were my best friend. So I'm very curious about writers and authors. Is it out of catharsis they start the journey, or is it about the world of imagination they get into and they look at characters and they want to build on those characters and create those plots? Or it's also a bit of therapy going on while they're building those characters for the self, right? You have to be part of it somewhere.
So I think it's a combination of everything, as you've observed so acutely. They say, don't they, that don't be nasty to an author. They might just kill you.
Yeah.
So you get to play God. And it's very nice to play God because you have no control over any other aspect in your life. And the only aspect you have. Think you have control is over your characters, but sometimes even your characters don't let you control them. They do just exactly what they want to do. As for it being catharsis, yes, I think your first book would definitely be semi-autobiographical in many ways, and you need to get that out of your system. You need to get it out. So many people do tell me that K-Mera is a lot like me, or a lot like I used to be, I think, back then. Suburban school gate mom of a 6-year-old now who's 18. So a lot of it doesn't apply. And once that is out of the way, then the stories you really need to tell start coming out of you. So, but there are stories that need to be told to the world and stories you need to tell only to yourself. And you need to have the courage to know the difference. So that is something I think that's all writers, authors, novelists, fiction writers, non-fiction writers, essays, memoirs, everyone should be very aware of what you need to tell the world and what you don't.
Okay, this is very interesting because this also brings in the social responsibility part to creative expression, right?
To a certain extent, yes.
To a certain extent. So how much of that filter do you put while writing now?
For instance, I would not like to write anything that would upset my family. So when I have been pretty upfront and vocal about female sexuality to a certain extent, I even did a column at the DNA called Storm in a Sea Cup for a long time. And then I got asked by publishing houses if I would like to write some erotica. First I said, yeah, why not? Then I thought to myself, okay, I have a teen son. It might friends can be very nasty and mean, so I don't want to get into that space. And upset him with that. So these are filters I set on myself. These are filters that, you know, I could possibly write it, but maybe I'm not brave enough, or maybe I don't want to embarrass my son. That's the only thing. I don't want him to, you know, grow up and say, my mother traumatized me by her writing and now I have to go for infinite hours of therapy and and yes, whatever, whatever.
So, sure. So yeah. You once said in an interview of yours, by liberating women, we are also liberating men. And this is a very powerful thought. Can you expand on this for our listeners?
I think that we don't think enough about the shackles that we put on men. There is so much of expectation on men to be the bread earner, to be strong, to be macho, to be to take charge of any situation, to not be vulnerable, to not show their vulnerability. These are things that affect them as much as, you know, other things affect women. How we tend to shrink women in, we tend to expect men to expand. And these are unfair expectations from either gender. So when we are giving our girls the courage to be strong, brave, free, independent, we also need to release our boys to be just who they want to be. If they want to be gentle, if they want to be creative, if they want to be artistic, if they want to be vulnerable, we need to give them the permission to do. It's none of our business to give permission, but we need to accept it if that's the way they are. And I think our generation, we are like on a cusp, and while raising a boy, I'm very acutely aware of, you know, any preconditioning that I may put into him if I, you know, if he thinks that he's not meant to cry because he's a boy. I've tried to remove it. If I see any sexism, unconscious sexism that he shows, I try to talk to him about it. But our men are as vulnerable as our women are, and it's just that the men and the boys are as vulnerable to unfair expectations. And this entire thing about toxic masculinity that we are battling, where does it come from? It comes from that weight of expectations for them to be macho, to be mard ka bachcha, to be all these things that, you know, we sort of inflict on them, and not counter it or not explain it or not tell them why it is not acceptable or why they should not be in a certain way. So I think men and women both need us to stop being judgmental about them. That's basically what I think.
So very interesting point, because, you know, this year, International Women's Day, the theme was Break the Bias. And it's gender neutral, isn't it? It's not only for women. It's for men as well. And I'm raising a 5-year-old toddler at the moment. And he likes to watch, for example, Frozen movie. He likes the character Elsa. He's very curious. You know, the long hair and the song Let It Go. He's picked up the lyrics. He sings it out. He wants to just, you know, be in the character. And I question myself, you know, hey, are you sure you like this character, or you want to go play football, or you want to do something else? And I'm watching myself telling him that, right? And I'm watching myself consciously telling him that. And that's the first seeding which parents are doing, putting those conditions. This is for boys and this is for girls and this is not okay and this is okay. So, my journey as a parent has just started out, but I'm sure with a 13-year-old, you've gone 18-year-old now. Yeah. Yeah. Wow. So, you know, the other thing is with this entire piece of how the narrative for women has changed, you know, whether you see films or books or it could be OTT content, the narrative of women playing the main protagonist or being different from how she was portrayed 10, 20 years ago. I think that also is bringing a change, isn't it?
I think it's a very chicken and egg thing. It's happening in society to a certain extent. That's why it gets reflected in our movies. And because it is happening in our movies, more women tend to emulate it and think that it's okay and it's aspirational and it's perfectly fine to be in a certain way. And I'm glad it is, to be honest. I'm glad, you know, the narratives are changing. And I'm glad that there are more women writing women in our OTT platforms. And, you know, we have some very strong characters, and we have shows that, like, like FOMO shots. We had a Tara many, many years ago before the entire, thing. And that was like revolutionary for the time. And now we have a FOMO shot. So whatever, I'm not very tuned into the other things. But I'm glad that we are looking at characters who are not, too unidimensional or two-dimensional or what society expects women to be, giving and sacrificing. And the black and white is no longer sacrosanct. Gray is acceptable, and that's important because we need to know that and understand that women come in all shades, black, white, gray, whatever. And as there are good women, there are not so good women out there. Whatever, I mean, whatever moral compass you want to judge them by, it's not for us to use our moral compass. It's the character and what the character stands for that we need to accept. So if the narratives are changing, more power to whoever's writing these wonderful characters.
Yeah, while the characters are changing and we say that, things are moving in the direction they should move, but do you think there are still major challenges women are facing, both professionally and personally? There's still a long way to go.
There will always be a long way to go. We've heard all the reports about how long it will take us to reach gender parity in the workforce, how long. Look at our representation in parliament. Look at the gender pay gap. Look at the figures for domestic violence or for violence against women or sexual violence against women. These are figures that are not figures that we can ignore or, downplay and say that things are getting better. These are still pretty scary things. And we are not at a stage socially like Iceland where, all the women go on a collective strike and say, unless I get equal pay, I'm not going to work or I'm not going to do any domestic duties. We are in such a patriarchal setup that is currently unthinkable for a nationwide strike, which would be ideal if women all of us said at one time data. We want the household responsibilities to be divided equally. But having said that, Shelja, I see the latest generation, the current generation of young couples being quite egalitarian in how they approach household responsibilities. I see fathers being quite, I'm talking from the urban perspective, of course. Rural is still a long way to go. I see them being pretty hands-on with diaper changing, with feed, night feeds. I see that happen. I see companies talking about paternity leave. I see little steps, baby steps happening, and that makes me happy. I see boys talking about consent and agency and understanding it and being respectful of it. There's also the horror of something like the boys' locker room, which we all saw last year. That also does exist. The fact that even if 1 out of 100 boys says that, okay, I'm going to respect your agency over your own body and I'm going to wait for consent. I think we're making small inroads somewhere and hopefully it should accelerate, hopefully. And that's our job as parents, honestly.
Sure. You're also associated with an NGO. Do you own it? Are you associated as a volunteer?
I was part of the founder members of India Helps and we set it up. It's a group of us. It was a group of us. And we set it up primarily after the 2611 attacks, terrorist attacks and bombing to help the victims. And we ran for as many years as it took to get them off, back on their feet and whatever, and put them in the Taj Trust. Tata Trust did a hell of a lot of heavy lifting. We were merely the connectors in some cases, raising funds for some, helping some, do their paperwork, little stuff. So it was a volunteer-led effort. And India Helps is no longer active, but we've done some hopefully good work.
So all women coming together?
Women and men.
Okay.
Women and men.
Okay. Great.
It's completely gender neutral.
So according to you, what makes a person unstoppable in their life?
That's a very, very good question. What makes a person unstoppable in life? Do we want to be unstoppable? Sometimes you need to stop and just regroup and take care of yourself. And, being unstoppable may lead to burnout. And I think we are too focused on the idea of just going on and soldiering on and doing stuff. But being unstoppable in the way that you ask, I mean it. I understand that you mean it in the sense of, you know, just going on. I think it's hope and it's belief and it's a faith in yourself to do what you want to do and not what is expected of you, what are the societal expectations of you. I think when you find that particular thing that gives you joy, you become unstoppable.
And you want to go back to that space again and again.
Yeah, because it's not a chore. It's not something that's coming from external pressure. It's something that drives you from within. That's when you become unstoppable.
So any advice for young writers, especially female writers, to be unstoppable at their pursuit of continuously write, practice, and improvise every day?
Earlier I would very, you know, grandiosely say write every day, but this pandemic has been hell and I have not written every day. So I would say read every day, even if you can't write every day, but stay in touch with your work. I see a lot of people saying that they want to be writers without putting in the necessary riyas. So you don't get to be a writer if you haven't put in the hours of writing work. You have to write every single day, whatever it is. You don't have to write to be published every single day, but you have to exercise. Like an athlete is not running a race every single day, but they're doing their workouts. So you have to do your workout. A singer does not give a performance every day, but she does her riyas. So you have to be in touch with your craft. You have to work at your craft. And if you are looking at writing to write a bestseller or to be on platforms or to be lauded or to be a celebrity writer, you're approaching it the wrong way. Write to tell the stories you want to tell. And don't write because, you know, okay, now I think mythologicals are doing great, so I should write a mythological fiction, or, you know, thrillers are doing great, so I should write that. Romances are selling well, so I should write that. You know, just be true to what you want to write and write the books that will last forever, not the books that will last for a year or whatever.
Any turning point in your life, Kiran, which turned you into an author? I know you told me that your mom inspired you, pushed you towards writing your first book. But was there any life event which triggered this and, you know, thrusted you towards that direction?
Yeah, mom was there. A couple of friends who sort of were sitting on my head, like Vikram or Vital, like, liko, liko, liko. But I think turning 40, so this was 10 years ago, 11 years ago. Okay. This was 11 years ago and I thought to myself, what have I really done with my life? I've done nothing. And that fear of, you know, having done nothing except like given birth to one specimen and done some odd freelance articles and whatever. I've done a hell of a lot of stuff, but nothing that would stay back after me. I think that was the fear, that I wanted something that would stay on after I went away. So turning 40, I think, put the fear of God into me and made me write.
So did you struggle with work-life balance ever, or it organically came to you after 40?
Does work-life balance ever come organically, Shelja? You're working, you have a kid, you know, it doesn't ever comes organically. We are like juggling all the balls possible, dropping some.
So I don't even want to call it balance, you're right, because he, like you said, you know, you're continuously juggling as a mother. Whether at work, back of the mind, you know, there are some things which you need to plan for home, and at home you are planning for. So it's not even a balance as much as your entire life is standing on a pivot, right? And that is something which is your core belief, your resilience, your value system. That is the space I'm talking about. Is there something which all this balance is standing on for you?
I think... The only thing that makes it possible is, touch wood, a husband who is very undemanding. Seriously, I mean, it may sound very non-feminist, but I think the best career investment a woman can make if she plans to get married is to choose a husband who supports her and who will say, fine, I don't care if, you know, you're not going to be running a perfect home or being the perfect wife or being the perfect mom. Just do what you want. and chill. So I guess he's just happy that I'm out of his hair, and that works for both of us. So, but I mean, I really hear some horror stories from my friends about how they have very, very demanding situations to be in. And I know that I would never be able to have done half the stuff that I've done if I had to be in that kind of a marriage.
Interesting. Very interesting. And off late, I've heard many women talk about this, you know, so this should come out in the open. It is all the balancing and the juggling is happening because of the pivot it all is standing on.
So, you know, there's, if I just tell you an anecdote, when my son's board exams were going on, I curated something called the Women Writers Fest for around 4 years. So I was, his board exams were on, and I was at this fest which I was organizing. I was there as a curator, and the mommy school WhatsApp group, how can you go? How can you leave the kid behind? And it's board exams. And I was like, his father's there. He has to do the studying. What do I do? You know, so this weight of expectations, I very happily transferred on to the dad who's cool with it. So that's any other person in that place would have said, like, how can you go? And the board exams are going on. And this is very irresponsible parenting, bagera, bagera, bagera. That kind of support is invaluable.
Right, right. This support, I think it just, you know, takes me back to a book which I read somewhere where you spoke about mental health, especially during postpartum period. And during that period is the time where a woman leans heavily on the family, right? Because you're in such a fragile phase of your life. Either your own family or your in-laws or your husband. And then you've written a book about all the issues women go through during that period. So was it from a personal experience again, to the inspiration to write that book, or it was just something which you wanted to share?
So the entire book is not about that. It's Karmic Kids. So just the chapter on, you know, it's divided in 10 parts from the first year to his 10th year. It's based on my blog. The blog was very successful. It was one of the top blogs of India for God knows how long. And people said that I was the Irma Bombeck of Bombay. And what Kristen Bell is saying now, Kiran Mandral said all those years ago, all that has happened with that blog and the book. So, so I've written about postpartum. I've written about what to expect, because I think we put motherhood on too much of a pedestal. And women go into it with, you know, rose-tinted glasses, thinking that they're going to see that little baby and say, oh, how sweet, and, you know, for dissolve into love. No, it doesn't happen that way. Your body is a mess. Your hormones are a mess. Your head is a mess. And you see this little ball of flesh and you think, what the hell now? You know, am I responsible for this? So my main thing was to put motherhood off the pedestal that we've placed it on, because honestly, you need to know what you're getting into. Every woman needs to know. And that's when I wrote about postpartum depression and what all happens. And yes, I did go through a bit of it, not very bad, thankfully. Luckily, I had enough support around me to handle the kid, to handle me at my worst. So I got out of it. A lot of women don't get that kind of help. And I think we really need to acknowledge as a people that it's very, very difficult. It takes a village. It really does take a village.
Right. I think you're right, because those 9 months, the nature is protecting you. The hormones are flowing in the right way. And the moment the kid is out, the hormones are gone. And my mom told me, Shailja, now you're feeling great. This is your 9th month. Believe me, when you're out of the hospital, you won't be the same person. So you are going to feel different. You know, it is going to take time too for the body and mind to come back to shape. And in fact, I think I read somewhere when I was doing a bit of my own research that it takes 9 months for the woman's body to come back to the shape it was, you know, before she conceived. So it's not like 3 months you're up and running and you can join back work. Even if women are joining back work in the 3rd month, the body is going through a lot of healing, right? Internally, a lot more is going on. So I think it's just... just a message out there, be kind to yourself.
Absolutely. Yeah. Having said that, I think I was back at work within a month.
Within a month. good for the mind, though. Good for the mind. And
No. I still, no. we were running our own agency and I had no choice because I was heading the department of creatives. But given a chance, and I would have taken longer time off.
So I did take 2 years as a sabbatical after a very long stint in my career of 18 years. I was very sure I can't do this multitasking. I just have to be there, completely present to the moment. Yeah, I mean, but now the guilt is back. My kid is almost going to be 5 years now, but I'm juggling with that thought. Okay, am I spending enough time with him? Am I a good mother? So all those feelings are back, but yeah, managing better.
Motherhood is the guilt that never stops giving.
Absolutely, so
you're
true.
Constantly going to feel guilty, whether you do something or you don't do something. So just do what you want to do.
So as a mother, what do you want for your child, Kiran?
One would say the universe and beyond, but no, I think I would just want him to be happy and content with whatever he does.
So at the age of 40, you put pressure on yourself, right?
I felt that I needed to do something, but I'm too laid back to put pressure on myself, Shelja. If I put pressure on myself, I would have been like, I don't know what, but I'm still very lazy.
Out of laziness, you have done spectacular work, Kiran. I mean, the stuff I've read about you, and I'm going to go on Amazon and order your books straight away. This is not sheer laziness. I think I see an amazing mind behind these books, and also a very versatile mind, right? To be able to write on so many genres, it's really amazing. And your in-depth knowledge on the authors which you follow. And I'm sure you've read every book of P.G. Woodhouse, haven't you? There you go.
Absolutely.
So, you know, coming back to the topic of, are we putting pressure on males, boys, men, on the masculinity part of it, or being the more manly part of versions of themselves? And I so agree with you, because I have attended these mindfulness workshops, or you call these spiritual retreats, in which technically gender doesn't matter. By the fourth or the fifth day, you're just stripped away from, you know, your egos are gone, your masks are gone. Female, male, it really doesn't matter. I've seen men crying. I have seen women being bowled out there. It really doesn't matter. So I get what you're saying. It's all these societal pressures which we put on ourselves and ingrained into our DNA and the parenting which we give to our children. But coming back to the same topic, right? So what does it mean to raise a feminist son, Kiran?
I think, and I've said this before, I think you raise a boy to recognize that boys and girls are equal in every way. He gets no special privileges because he's a boy. He cannot objectify a woman because he's a boy. No matter the amount of messages that he gets from popular culture. Popular culture is terrible. You know, all our popular culture is geared towards objectifying women. So you just need to keep countering that and telling him no. That this doesn't happen. Like, my son gets most annoyed with me because, you know, boys talk with all sorts of bad language amongst themselves. And the abuses are generally female directed, right? Hindi abuses.
Yeah.
And I keep saying, why do you say dash, whatever, mother, sister? Why not father, brother?
Yeah.
Make it equal opportunity if you're going to be abusive. So, they say, Mom, you don't have to take everything so seriously. I said, no, but if you're going to be using this language, then I want you to be abusing all genders equally, both genders equally. I mean, we still don't have the vocabulary for other, to include the other genders in this. But, and we shouldn't be abusing any gender to begin with. But I say that, think about why it is this way. Why are we only using abusive language towards one particular gender? Why is it only the women who are being, you know, abused? When you're talking to a boy, but you're using abusive language directed towards a woman. So it's this constant calling out that I think is important. When he was young and we were watching the cartoons, there used to be something called Doraemon.
Yeah.
So in Doraemon, I would see the boys would be sitting around doing whatever nonsense or whatever, playing some game or something. And the girl is bringing the food and the girl is serving them. And I would say, why is she doing it? Why is she not sitting and playing with them? And every time you see this, you need to keep calling it out to them. It does make you very annoying as a parent, but then they need, at some point, you know, the tube light will light up in their brain and they will say, this is not right. And recently there was some incident, I forget what it was, but then I was very proud when my son came and told me, that's not right, Mama, that's not fair. It was not her fault. Why are they saying it was her fault? So I said, okay, fine. Somewhere the message has got down. And somewhere, you know, he understands that we cannot be objectifying girls and we cannot be treating women as lesser creatures.
Right. So while talking about boys, I've also seen in a lot of your stories, right, you follow a female protagonist and that protagonist is balancing a lot of roles, whether it's a wife, a mom, an investigative journalist. So where does this, you know, again, you know, this entire protagonist who's multitasking and there is a consistency across the books. Is it coming from some message which you are trying to give?
Not really. So the female detective and her multitasking, she's not really multitasking, but she's trying to find purpose. So the message I don't know if there's a message, but it's really a social commentary on how women who drop out of the workforce find it so difficult to get back into the workforce. And why is it that it is the woman who generally tends to drop out of the workforce and be the primary caretaker for the child? In my other books, for instance, in Missing Presumed Dead, I talk about mental illness and how it can affect a marriage and how, you know, you don't really take a woman's mental illness so seriously, and she still has to perform her roles as a mother, as a wife, as whatever, while she's still battling something that is so grave. In More Things in Heaven and Earth, it's about being a widow when you're young, and how do you shut off your sexual needs and desires? How do you stop yourself from living on? How do you also mourn who you've lost and love that has gone away? So balancing this dichotomy of going on but also mourning, and how financial empowerment is so very important for women and independence is so very important for women. So it's not a conscious plan when I sit down to write that I'm going to write about this aspect of female empowerment when I write the story, but it somehow just comes into the narrative.
Sure. And it's organically coming through. Yeah, interesting. And it's also giving a message in a way, right? So there's always this approach which you have, which is bringing out that character very clearly. And I think it's going to resonate with women. The genesis of the show itself started with this, Kiran, that, you know, while women play many roles, somewhere along the way, they lose their own identity. And we wanted to keep the spirit of being unstoppable alive amongst women at large, and that's the reason we get women like yourself on the show who are completely unstoppable in the spirit, and which would inspire a lot many women out there. So tell me, in your novel More Things in Heaven and Earth, you said you wanted to explore being widowed, right? You just mentioned that. So in the story, your protagonist goes to extraordinary and even supernatural lengths for closures in the wake of her husband's demise. And it's a very interesting premise. So what inspired you?
So what inspired me, I think my mother lost her husband when she was very young. My father died when I was 8 or 9, between 8 and 9. And I've seen the kind of struggle that you go through as a woman. You're basically socially ostracized to a certain extent. You have to suddenly think about financial independence and earning your living and, you know, being financially solvent. Luckily, my protagonist, or unluckily, does not have a child to care for. But the kind of boxes that you get put into when you lose your husband, nothing really has changed. Even if this were written in the 1930s, I think nothing really has changed. Women are still looked at the same way, you know, you're not really encouraged to be anything but wallflower, so to speak, when you're a widow. So I wanted to look at it. She's in the prime of her life. She's 32. She's young. She's vibrant. She's radiant. But she's lost her husband. How does she move on? And what does she do? And this entire taboo about women not going on with their lives is something that really disturbed me. Why should life end when a man loses his wife? Before the ashes are even cold, they are deciding whom they can get him married off to. Right? We've all seen that happen. But a woman is supposed to be, okay, fine. Now your husband is dead. Now you live out a life on the shelf.
Right. So it's not only genres which you've tapped into, right? From horror to supernatural to humor. It's also the emotions which you've brought out amongst readers. So it's a very, very, very interesting, you know, a peek into your mind and the way you approach your storytelling, Kiran. All your fiction, nonfiction, I think is very inspiring from a woman perspective, because we get to understand women not only from the roles which are defined, but also how to operate within those roles. You know, how to survive within those roles is the sense I'm getting, right? So it's a very ground up learning. I think it's your personal journey, which I think is reflecting in your stories a bit. So before we go, Kiran, we have a few quick questions for you. For you, is writing a form of catharsis or a world of imagination? Yes or no?
Yes and no, I would say.
Okay.
So there's a bit of catharsis and a bit of imagination.
Are you an extrovert or a private person?
Oh, I'm terribly introverted. I hate meeting people. If I could live in... there are times when I don't step out of my house for weeks.
If not an author, whom would you like to be today?
If not an author, I think I would have been an artist, because I was very fond of and pretty good at painting too, but somehow I didn't pursue that.
Are you still pursuing that?
No, not really. I dabble in it occasionally, but not with any seriousness. And I know that it's not good enough to do seriously.
Okay. So quote an instance where you broke a bias or got inspired by someone who did it.
I can't think of a single one. But I would say, I think it was getting back to work very quickly, even before the 40 days thing was up. No, I think the 40 days was up or something. But the fact that I needed to be there at home with the kid, I was lucky that I had support to do that. And I had my mother-in-law and enough house help. And I know I speak from a place of privilege, and not many women have that advantage. But I think the fact that I did not let mommy guilt weigh me down, and was something that was pretty brave at that point. I don't know whether I'll live to regret it, but I think it was pretty brave.
Okay, so that basically brings us to almost the end of the show, but I would want to ask you if you want to say anything to our listeners before we let you go.
So I love the premise Unstoppable, Shelja. I really love it. And I think we stop ourselves very often as women. We limit ourselves. We think, I can't do this. I'm not good enough. How can I apply for that job? I don't have all the qualifications required. So let us, you know, not do that. Let us not self-limit ourselves. Let us just go ahead and do what we want, even to the extent that they call you cocky or demanding or arrogant or, you know, ambitious. Forget about what they label you. Just do what gives you joy and pleasure, and that's enough to live a happy life. Or to be happy within yourself that you've done what you want to do.
Right. Right. So it's the spirit of Unstoppable without any labels and boundaries, right? It's the way you define it for yourself.
Absolutely.
So Kiran, thank you so much for coming on the show. I think it's been such interesting conversation, insights into your life. And I would really want you to come back on the show. It'll be a privilege. And I wish you all the best for all your future endeavors.
Thank you so much for inviting me, Shailja. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Same here.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to The Riveting Conversation. As always, remember to subscribe and follow us on your favorite podcast app. If you like the show, remember to rate us on Apple Podcast and Spotify. It helps us to improve.